pleased to have the opportunity of coming and speaking about the history of Zion Trowbridge this evening. Firstly, just a few brief comments as to who I am. Well, as has been mentioned, I'm a member of the Society Committee. I'm also a deacon at Zion Chapel in Trowbridge. And my family can trace their membership in the church at Zion back to the formation of the church 200 years ago. My children are the eighth generation to be in membership of the church, so perhaps I am qualified to know something of the history of the church. But this year we are celebrating 200 years, and has been mentioned, I have, well, the church has produced a book. And I decided when we were talking about the title that Two Centuries of Grace would be a title which would portray the history of the church, the grace of God to the church at Trowbridge over 200 years. Now, we only have one copy here this evening, but there are a number of flyers upstairs which give your information on the back as to how to order the copy with details of postage as well. So if you have a look at those upstairs later on. Also this year we have produced a Zion calendar covering the 200 years with pictures of the past, and these also are available upstairs, a reduced price now because we're partly through the year, of £2 each. Also in September the Society are having an open day at Zion, and that's on the 28th of September, which I hope will be from probably midday through till about 4:30. And that coincides with a historical exhibition which we're putting on to display the 200 years of the church. And I shall be giving a talk in the afternoon about the history of the church. And following that, we're having what we're calling a traditional chapel tea. So if you would like to put that date in your diary, please, the 28th of September this year. We're pleased to see you there. Right, so we come on to tonight's lecture. Zion Trowbridge, the first 100 years. Now the question you may be asking is, well, the fact the church at Zion is 200 years this year, why are we only considering 100 years? Well, the answers are several. We have a limited time today. And secondly, the closer the events of the past, the less they can be put into an historical setting. And thirdly, the recent events at Zion involve those who are still living, who whose families are still alive. So in some ways we cannot look back so clearly there. It's interesting that in the centenary booklet, which was published in 1913, Simeon Champkins came across the same situation. There were two pastors from the first 100 years who were still alive in 1913. And he only mentions two of them by name. One of them actually died in 1916, as we will see. But with the advancement of time, so we can look back in more detail at these pastors. So in the 200 years of the church's history, there have been 10 pastors at Zion. And they neatly divide themselves into five in the first 100 years and five in the next 100 years. Now the picture behind me, the quality of which is not that clear, but this picture shows some of the congregation actually at Zion on the 6th of January this year, which was the 200th anniversary to the day of the formation of the church. But tonight we're going to look briefly at the formation of the church. We're going to look at John Warburton, the first pastor, but only in a very limited way. As we will see, much has been written about him already. And then in more detail, the next four pastors. And those four pastors were Samuel Sargent, William Schofield, Alfred Peat, and Simeon Champkins. So as an introduction, I want to tell you about some of the sources that I've used in my research. Now, when you go upstairs later on for your refreshments, you'll see a table with a selection of archives from Zion. This is a very small selection. We have got a lot of archive material. So the primary sources that we have used to look at the history of the church. I'm sure you're all familiar with the autobiography of John Warburton, Mercies of a Covenant God, the first part which was published in 1838. And that is available upstairs for purchase today. And then, more recently, there was the publication of John Warburton, Servant of a Covenant God, by John Broom. And I want to pay tribute today to John Broom, who was called to his eternal rest on the 14th of February this year. And he was a member of the church at Zion, not a member of the church at Zion, but he was a member of the church at the Havre, but his Thanksgiving service was held at Zion. And it was fitting, I think, that that should be the case, because the amount of research which he had done into the life of John Warburton. We also have a book in 1890, which was published by a Wiltshire pastor called William Dawell, called 20 Golden Candlesticks. And I have a copy here. 20 Golden Candlesticks gives the history of the Baptist churches in the Trowbridge area. And then following on from that book, in 2005, I produced a book, because 20 Golden Candlesticks only goes up to 1890. So a lot of people said, well, what happened to all these churches from 1890 onwards? So I produced this book, which is 20 Golden Candlesticks Revisited, which is the story of the same churches in the area from 1890 up to 2005. As I mentioned, the archives of Zion, due to the diligence of my predecessors, the deacons at Zion, they seem to throw little away. And we have almost complete set of church records for the past 200 years. There's a complete membership list. We have church minutes for 151 years and a few miscellaneous earlier ones. We have Sunday school minutes for 155 years. We have treasurer's account records for the whole of the 200 years, and a multitude of other documents, posters, photographs, and other records. So these were some of the sources which I've used to write the book, Two Centuries of Grace. Now we see a picture of the present interior of the chapel. Well, the origin of the church then at Zion. The origin of Baptist history in Wiltshire can be traced back into the 1600s. And a few miles from Trowbridge, there is a village called Southwick. And this village is well known for having an open-air baptistry, which we see in this picture. And this spot has been used over the last 250 years for the baptism of believers. The present church at Southwick can be dated back to at least 1655. Now, there may have been earlier links, possibly with the Lollards, who we know were active in that part of the country, those followers of John Wycliffe. But by the 1660s, during the persecution of the 1660s, the Southwick Baptists were meeting in a wood. And they were meeting in this wood called Witchpit Wood. And in this wood, there still exists a natural dell, some way from the road, a very secluded site, so you could see anybody approaching this wood very clearly. A good place for meeting in secret. And we know that there are at least 150 Anabaptists later recorded as meeting in Trowbridge. So this was the beginning of the Baptist churches in Trowbridge. And that church was called the Cunnagher Church. Now, the church at the Cunnagher was formed about the year 1697. But by the 18th century, the early 18th century, the church had drifted into Unitarian views. And there were a number of people who were unable to accept this stance, and they formed a new church. And this is the building, which was for many years known as Backstreet Chapel. They were formed in 1736. Now, one of the pastors at Backstreet Chapel was a man called Nathaniel Rawlings. And On the 7th of December 1809, the Baptist Reporter and Missionary Intelligencer contained this report concerning Backstreet. After the death of Mr. Wickenden in 1759, the pulpit was supplied by various ministers until 1765. Among the number, there appears the names of Hugh and Caleb Evans, Benjamin Francis, Thomas and John Kingdom. In 1763, Mr. N. Rawlings supplied the pulpit and continued to do so at intervals until December 1765, when he became the stated minister and was ordained in 1769. Owing to some unpleasant circumstances, Mr. Rawlings left in 1771, but resumed his office in 1778 and held it until his death in 1809, at the venerable age of 75. Mr. Rawlings came from the church of Mr. Benjamin Bedham, Boughton-on-the-Water, Gloucestershire, and was a faithful and successful minister of the gospel, having personally baptized about 175 persons. As a man, a Christian, and a minister, I think I may say he was respected by all who knew him. So this was Nathaniel Rawlings. But the Backstreet Church book on 6th of October 1809 records, "Died our beloved, worthy, and esteemed minister and pastorate, the Reverend Nathaniel Rawlings, of a bilious complaint, about 7 o'clock in the morning, after a confinement of up to 4 months, having held honourably and faithfully the charge of this church for 38 years, first in October 1765 to May 1771, and from November 1777 to this time. The last 32 years he was happy with his people, and they united to him. He was interred on Friday the 13th in a vault near the meeting house door. Joseph Cliff spoke on the occasion, and a funeral discourse was preached the Sunday evening, following by Mr. Barnett of Bradford. In the evening, a text chosen by our deceased pastor, 'Christ is all and in all.'" So we see this church at Backstreet in 1809 losing their pastor, Nathaniel Rawlings. And they consider the next pastor of the church at Backstreet. And they called a man to the vacant pastorate from Liverpool. And this man was the name of Richard Davis. He came from Samuel Medley's church in Liverpool, and the Backstreet Church agreed to invite him to preach with a view. And it was the preaching of Richard Davis that was to cause much controversy, particularly concerning the free offer of the gospel. Davis was one who followed the views of Andrew Fuller, who was opposed to the view taken by others, including William Gadsby and John Warburton. Of Fuller, William Gadsby wrote, "He was the greatest enemy the Church of God ever had, as his sentiments were so much cloaked with the sheep's clothing." So this obviously presented problems in the church at Backstreet. And events moved on, and William Gadsby himself came to preach in Bath in 1811. And he was approached by two of the men from Backstreet, Samuel Hurd and William Ecott. And these two were leaders of this group who were opposed to Davis's preaching. So William Gadsby now was invited to preach in Trowbridge in 1812. Now Richard Davis would not allow Gadsby to preach in Backstreet Chapel, and no other place in Trowbridge would either, apart from the Cunnagher Chapel. So there he preached some stage in 1812. But by the end of 1812, 49 members felt it was right to leave the church at Backstreet, and 41 of these were formed into a new church, which became Zion. So we see the formation of the church at Zion on the first Sunday of the year, 3rd of January 1813. They met for worship for the first time, and they met in this room in Wicker Hill. And it was here on the 6th of January that the church came into formation. Now, having left Backstreet Chapel and met in this room, they hired an upper room in this building at a cost of £16 per annum. It was a large room, which would seat about 300 people. So this then was the church and its background. But before long, they were to call their first pastor. Now, it's been interesting looking back over the history of the church to see the future years of interregnum. And the church has considered many people during those years of interregnum, but for a variety of reasons, they felt unable to accept. But the first man the church considered, the first man the church approached, was to lead that church for the next 42 years. And God's blessing was seen on that call. And that man was John Warburton. Now, as I say, it's not my intention to say much regarding Warburton today, as much has been written in his autobiography and his recent biography. And the subsequent four pastors of the church are much less known, and I want to consider them in more detail. But obviously I need to touch on John Warburton. Now, John Warburton was born in 1776 near Manchester, and he was baptised by William Gadsby, and he was called to the pastorate of the church in Rochdale at the beginning of 1810. The church had come into existence in 1809. But it was not until 1811 that Warburton was actually able to move to Rochdale. And he records that he walked 18 miles each weekend to Rochdale and back for a whole year. But then how did the church at Trowbridge come to hear of John Warburton? It was probably through William Gadsby. And in January to March 1814, Warburton preached in Trowbridge. And then he preached for a further month in 1815. But it was to the church at Maidstone, which he had received a call, that, humanly speaking, Warburton felt was the right way. He said Trowbridge had no appeal to him. But the Lord had other plans. And the night before the answer had to be given to the Trowbridge people, the words from Acts 18, "Abide in this city, for I have much people here," were so impressed on his mind that any desire to go to Maidstone, or presumably to remain at Rochdale, although that fact has not been mentioned, had been taken away from him in an instant, and to Trowbridge he must come. Now this lady here is the only known picture I know of Lydia Warburton, Mrs. Warburton. And on the 29th of March 1815, John and Lydia and his family left Rochdale on a three-day journey via stagecoach to Wiltshire. They arrived on the 1st of April, and the following day he preached his first sermon as pastor in that upper room. And the next question we must ask about Warburton is, to what extent did the Wiltshire people understand John Warburton's broad Lancashire accent? Or how much did John Warburton understand of the broad Wiltshire accent? Well, the question is unanswered, but there were many people who came to hear him preach. But as an aside, when my great-great-grandfather, a Wiltshireman called William Kilminster, moved from Wiltshire to Yorkshire in the 1890s, he was called a little German by the people of Haworth because they couldn't understand what he was on about. But the preaching of Warburton was so blessed by God that the church grew, and soon the room, which held 300 to 400 people, was far too small. So Zion Chapel was built the following year. Now, later in the pastorate, John Kershaw, Warburton's successor at Rochdale, records in 1834, "I was well pleased to see such a large chapel well filled with an attentive congregation. The second Lord's Day evening I went to the chapel, all was full, so that it was with difficulty I could reach the pulpit. The word of God was blessed, and the chapel was crowded with 800 to 1,000 regular attenders." But there were, however, problems and division in the church at Trowbridge. In 1826, there had been a group who had left over the building of an indoor baptistry. And in the later years, in the 1850s, there were other problems. Here we see Warburton in his later years. And in May 1852, The earthen vessel comments concerning the church at Trowbridge. A very sad and dreadful eruption has for some time past existed in the church, over whom our much and long esteemed old friend John Warburton has for so many years and with so much usefulness been placed. We heard all the particulars of it when in Trowbridge, but should have taken no notice of it had we not found that nearly all the churches in the land are somewhat disturbed and afflicted with it. We beseech the brethren not to give heed to flying slanders, but to read them for themselves a pamphlet just published, entitled A Series of Letters by Several Members of the Church of Christ Meeting for Worship at Zion Chapel, under the pastoral care of Mr. John Warburton Sr., showing the cause of the unhappy divisions now ruling amongst them. The article continues, we have carefully perused every line in that pamphlet. It is to us a very painful, yea, most awful affair. The letters in the pamphlet are weighty and demand the most serious attention of all who in any measure are instrumental in bringing about such a state of things. One part of the title struck us almost with terror. It is this, showing the cause of the unhappy divisions now ruling amongst them. On perusing the letters, we found the cause clearly traced up and consistently pointed out. Surely some of the influential ministers in that particular section of the church should endeavour to bring about a resolution. But it seems that these problems continued right up to the time of John Warburton's death. And he died on the 2nd of April 1857, 42 years to the day that he preached his first sermon as pastor of the church. The church membership records tell us that during those 42 years, 409 were added by baptism and 143 other churches. But we need to move on. And we need to move on to the events after Warburton's death. In 1863, a schoolroom was added to the chapel over the burial ground, which had been closed in 1855. And in 1866, they marked the jubilee of the building of the chapel, when John Kershaw again came and spoke. Now, as is often the case with such a long and established pastorate, there would have been few in the church who would have known a time without Warburton. And the church seemed to be unable to reach a decision on any successor to the pastorate. And there appeared to be no direct leading to anyone until 1865, when the church discussed the ministry of Samuel Sargent. Now, what do we know about Samuel Sargent? Well, he was not a very well-known minister. As far as I know, no picture exists of him. I could find no obituary of him. And there's very little written information about this man. As I mentioned, the centenary booklet sheds very little light on him. To quote, in 1867, Mr. Sargent accepted the call of the church to become its pastor. His labours were of short duration. He resigned the office in 1868 after holding it 1 year. Not much information there. So who was this Samuel Sargent? Why was so little known about him in 1913? Well, maybe the author of the centenary account couldn't find out very much, as the church archives show very little about him. But in searching various sources, I have found some details about this man, Samuel Sargent. He was born in about 1824 in Cambridge. He was baptised in Coggleshall in Essex in October 1837 as a young man. But the church book is silent on where he came from or when he first preached at Zion. The supply list doesn't start till 1873, so that doesn't give us any more information. So time to do some investigating. Now, the first mention I find of Samuel Sargent is in the church records Salhouse in Norfolk. And the church book at Salhouse records on the 6th of October 1844, S. Sargent received a member of this church from the particular Baptist church at Great Yarmouth. And then the 8th of October, 2 days later, S. Sargent ordained at a 10 o'clock service, followed by dining in the vestry, Afternoon service, 2 p.m., George Wright of Beccles preached. Now, there were a number of churches in Great Yarmouth, but we learn that in February 1845, Mrs. Sargent, who was a member of the church meeting in Row 15, Great Yarmouth, asked to join the Salhouse Church. Now, the rows were an area of Great Yarmouth, and the chapel there is described as a Baptist chapel midway on the north side of Row 15, who established themselves there in the 18th century, a meeting house, the trusts of which were declared by deed enrolled in 1789. And the information tells us that the chapel was later dismantled in 1870. So we see Samuel Sargent is now pastor of the church in Salhouse. But seemingly it was not long before problems arose. And the Salhouse Church book records in September 1845 that for several months, Mr. Bowden, a member of the church, has been connected with a musical band composed wholly of carnal persons and had performed both privately and publicly, therefore conforming to the world and bringing great reproach upon the truth of God. The pastor had written to Mr. Bowden, and the pastor had interviewed Mr. Bowden, and while he acknowledged he was wrong, he was not prepared to give up his position in the band. So the church sent two members to interview Mr. Bowden. The next month, the pastor again interviewed Mr. Bowden to inquire if he had given up this unscriptural practice. He had not, nor did he intend to do so. However, this meeting went is not clear, but the church decided that the pastor and Mr. Bowden should both leave the church meeting while they discussed the matter further. And the decision was made to defer the matter for 2 months and not to allow Mr. Bowden to sit down at the Lord's Supper. Mr. Bowden was excluded from the church in December 1845, and you would think there the matter would end. However, in March 1846, the church decided to form a committee of 9 men to investigate the matter of Sargent and Bowden. 9 men. The church must have felt the matters needed sorting out. After this, the matter of Mr. Bowden and the band seems to go quiet. However, at a meeting in June 1846 called by Mr. Sargent, he gave the church 1 month's notice of his resignation, and the church asked him to supply until Michaelmas 1846. And that September, it was agreed that Mr. Sargent's time was up and he should leave. But the church record says on the 22nd of November 1846, having been interrupted several times in our place of worship by the undermentioned members, it was agreed with the 28 members present that Mr. and Mrs. Sargent, Mr. and Mrs. Newstead, and Robert London be separated, and G. Hawke from the deacon's office. The record continues. After this, a long case of litigation between the late pastor and the people of his charge, a lamentable disruption took place, where the late pastor and a number of members opened another place of worship in this parish. And this was Rehoboth Chapel in Salhouse. So in 1851, the Sargent family are still in Salhouse. And as I said, there was no known obituary of Samuel Sargent, but there is an obituary of his first wife in the Gospel Standard of 1862. And that does shed a little more light on the family and their movements. For by 1855, they had left Salhouse and had moved to Northamptonshire. Their stay there was short because in November 1857, he moved to the pastorate here at Ellsworth in Cambridgeshire. Now, the obituary of Sarah continues. In July 1861, we removed to Fenstanton, the doctor assuring us there was no hope of my dear wife's health becoming better unless we lived in a drier situation. About a month after this, the symptoms of dropsy made their appearance, and only once after our removal was my dear wife able to attend chapel here in Fenstanton. So Sarah Sargent died on the 13th of September 1861 at the age of 39. And Samuel Sargent soon remarried. So this gives us a brief background to the man Samuel Sargent. But then we move on to the church in Trowbridge. And in 1866, Samuel Sargent was asked to supply the pulpit with a view for 3 months. And he commenced on the first Sunday in July 1866. And he was invited to the pastorate. And on the 28th of December 1866, the deacons received a reply from Samuel Sargent accepting the call on the following 3 conditions. Firstly, that the custom of school children singing in any public service, i.e. Sunday school anniversary, be abolished. Secondly, that he be allowed 6 Lord's Days each year for going out to preaching, the expense of the supplies for the pulpit being met by himself. Thirdly, no person be allowed to occupy the pulpit if his doing so not be agreeable to both pastor and church. Well, the second and third conditions, we may say, are quite normal. We'd say quite reasonable. But the first, we might ask, why was he wanting to make it a condition of his acceptance that the Sunday school anniversary be no longer held and his emphasis on the children singing in it? Now, it's not clear when at Zion this practice started, but we know that there were other Baptist chapels in Trowbridge and certainly many Midland and Northern strict Baptist causes where Sunday school anniversary was until recent times a regular event. But it was with the agreement to these 3 rules the pastorate began on the first Sunday in January 1867. Now, that same month, January 1867, the teachers held their annual tea meeting. And they took part into, quote, singing sacred music with a piano forte. The pastor objected to this, and consequently, the teachers, the record says, felt much annoyed. Now, given the events that we've seen at Salhouse, now in Trowbridge, maybe we should ask if Samuel Sargent had something against music. The band member at Salhouse, the Sunday school anniversary, and now the teachers on the piano. It can't be an issue with the use of music in the worship of God's house because it involved the man in the band. So what was it? I doubt that we will ever know. But by April the same year, the pastor must have felt things were not right, as he wrote to the deacons telling them if 2/3 of the members should wish his resignation, then 3 months' notice should be given him. Now, I've recently come across an article from the Christian's Monthly Record, which describes the situation which was existing in Zion at that time. The writer says, "We wended our way to Zion Chapel, in which we had many times heard the voice of our old departed friend Warburton. On entering, our hearts sank within us. A gentlemanly-looking man ascended the pulpit stairs. Of course, he had on the indispensable neckcloth, without one who would think of appearing in a pulpit. There might have been 70 present, as the clerk waited about 3 minutes before he began to give out the hymn. And meantime, and for a short time afterwards, there was a constant ingress of people. To somewhere about 250 had taken their seats. But only imagine 250 in a place constructed for 700. And in the evening, there were still less, there being about 2 dozen in the gallery opposite us. We thought of days gone by, and as we have said, our hearts sank within us. Not that the truth is not still preached within the walls, for we believe it is, but it's not preached in the way which old John preached it. It sounded to us like a pupil reciting a piece, which having got off by heart, it lacked that force and power. We think that must attend a discourse that comes from the heart. However rough and ungrammatical the expressions, here the language was correct, except the preacher would call law, Laura, draw, drawer, and saw, sawer. And that his delivery was so studiously deliberate to sound like an affliction. But for those things, we would not have cared a straw if only we could have been sure the speaker was feeling what we were hearing. For the well-taught and deeply exercised and tried congregation, there was not a word of instruction, reproof, or encouragement." So with the church and pastor thus described, is it at all surprising that the church now numbered 170, 12 members less than 2 years earlier, and in 1867 none were baptized and the congregation drastically reduced. So in December 1867, the church discussed this low state of affairs, and 115 members voted in favour of giving the pastor 3 months' notice to leave. And by the end of March 1868, Samuel Sargent had left Zion. Later, he was pastor at Lakenheath from 1871 to 1881. Now, I have a copy of his death certificate, which shows that he died from laryngitis while staying with his son in London in 1882. But the centenary book tells us that the church was again in a state of widowhood, and this remained until 1882. And in 1881, William Schofield, who we see here, a member of Hope Rochdale, John Warburton's former church, was invited to preach at Zion. Now, William Schofield was in his time a well-known minister, and I would suggest that he, with Champkins, were after Warburton the two most well-known pastors of the church during the period that we are considering. So a brief biographical sketch of William Schofield. William Schofield was born in 1837 in Bent Meadows, Lancashire. Now, his parents were hand loom weave operators, and William married a local girl, Hannah Chadwick. And her parents ran a grocery and baker's shop in Rochdale. And the couple were married by John Kershaw in Hope Chapel, Rochdale, in 1861. We go to Rochdale. William had begun work in the local mill at the age of 4. And by the age of 7, he was paid 2 shillings and 2 pence for 36 hours a week. By the age of 11, he was working 72 hours a week. His parents could not work, so he was the main wage earner, keeping his father and mother and 5 children, 2 of whom were now working, each bringing home 4 shillings and 2 pence a week. The rent of their cottage, he says, was 2 shillings and 2 pence. Flour cost 6 shillings and potatoes 2 shillings a stone. They were indeed the hungry 40s. So William received no formal education, but later on Sunday mornings he attended a mathematical school. But by the age of 18, he had become an errand boy, an apprentice for his cousin Reuben, who had a small drapery business near the market in Rochdale. And trade worsened, and during the American Civil War, the mills closed and people had no money at all. However, the situation was to improve, and in 1865, William formed a business as a flannel manufacturer with Edmund Lord, his brother Isaac, and a relation of Thomas Chadwick. And by the 1860s and 70s, trade had improved, and they moved to a larger mill, Spring Mill, in Smallbridge in 1879. William himself was baptised by John Kershaw in 1861, but we now consider his call to preach. That came some years afterwards, but he firstly started to resist the call to preach. Towards the end of John Kershaw's life in 1869, John Kershaw was unable to preach, so it was arranged that Mr. Leach of Hollingwood preach at Rochdale. But the Rochdale deacons would provide a minister for the church at Hollingwood, and William was to be that preacher. So John Kershaw sent word to him. William wanted to remain in his position as Sunday school superintendent, but John Kershaw said, "You must go to Hollingwood." And William could not go against his dying pastor's wish, so off he went to Hollingwood, walking 8 miles to preach. Now, soon afterwards, William took his turn to address the school at Rochdale. In the end, one of the oldest members, George Crabtree, came up to him and said, "William, I am more and more persuaded that the Lord means you for the work of the ministry." William replied, "George, the Lord has not told me so yet, and until he does, I'm not going out at the bidding of any man." So after Kershaw's death in January 1870, one Sunday morning, the minister engaged did not arrive. And the senior deacon said, "We must all sit in the communion pew. I will give out a hymn and pray. Benjamin, thou must do the same. William, thou must read a chapter and say something about it and close the service." He says, "I read John 14 and commented on the first two verses for about half an hour. At the close of the service, many of the aged members said that they were not sorry they were without a minister, for this will be the means of forcing out William." William was still reluctant, but eventually he started to preach. And he made the following remarks about his preparation. "I got my Bible and concordance and searched the word, comparing text with text. And this I have found to be a great means of coming to a good understanding of the word." His first visit to Trowbridge was on 15th of May 1881, and that was caused by the illness of Jabez Edison, who was at that stage Pastor Accrington, but was later to follow Kershaw and Warburton at Rochdale. And Edison suggested that William Schofield should preach in his place. So William Schofield supplied the church at Zion for a month with a view to the pastorate in February 1882. And in March 1882, he was invited to the pastorate, 137 members voting for and two against. The new pastorate began on the 7th of January 1883. And we see here the chapel at Zion as it looks now, as it looked then, a large chapel which seats about 500 people. And William Schofield's first text was, "O Lord, I beseech thee, send prosperity." William says, "I showed what prosperity consisted of and what it was not, and that God alone could send it. We did not want numbers to deaden the church in divine things, and yet we want numbers to occupy those empty seats, if so be the Lord would bless the word to the good of their souls." And he says, "After a short time, strangers began to turn in. The word was blessed to many, and in 3 years there was not a seat to be let in the place." 1st of July 1883 saw 16 baptized and 5 received from the churches. And in 1884, the total members reached 211, the highest point ever in the church's history. But to lose a pastor whose ministry was such well used and had lasted only a few years would be to many unthinkable. But in 1887, William Schofield announced that his health was suffering from the climate of the west of England, and he felt he must return to his native north country. William Schofield died in Asdale, Lancashire, on the 2nd of November 1923 at the age of 85, and his widow, Hannah Lord Schofield, 2 years later. So again, another pastorless period at Zion follows. And now we come to consider the fourth pastor. And this man is Alfred Peat. Now, Alfred Peat came from the church at Tring, and he was baptized there in 1859. And he was then pastor at the Old Baptist Chapel in Sharnbrook, Bedfordshire, from 1865, which was the year that the chapel was built there. And he first supplied the church at Zion in July 1893, and in 1895 the deacons booked him for as many Sundays as possible in 1895 and 1896. And a unanimous call was given to him in February 1896, which he accepted. And the recognition service was held on the 8th of September 1896. This was a full day. It was the day of the 80th anniversary of the chapel, and this was marked by Charles Hemington preaching in the morning and Robert Moxton in the afternoon, with the recognition service in the evening. There's now a break in the church history. For the first time, we have no church records for a short period. The church minutes from 1881 to 1897 are missing, and the deacon's minutes end in 1894. But we do know that during this time, one event did happen, and that was the pastor married. Now, it's significant, as future events will see, as to who he married. He married a lady called Sarah Gore, and Sarah was the sister of one of the deacons at the time, John Gore. But during 1900, Alfred Peet suffered a stroke and he had to conduct services seated in the pulpit. But by February 1901, the situation in the church was such that 44 members were concerned about the financial condition of the church and decreasing number of worshippers that they wrote to the deacons requesting the pastor's resignation. It seemed as if a similar situation was emerging as that which had been in 1867. The deacons wrote to Mr. Peet and they informed the pastor that they were in agreement with the 44 members and they asked him to peacefully resign at once and they would pay his salary up to the end of June 1901. So he resigns and Mr. and Mrs. Peet and their daughter Gertrude left Trowbridge and moved to Fenstanton. And it was here that he died in February 1916 and was laid to rest in the chapel graveyard. So again we see a vacant pastorate in the church at Zion. The church discussed in particular two well-known men, James Calcott, pastor of Ebenezer Old Hill, and John Snow, a well-known pastor in the denomination. And he was invited, but he declined. So we come to their next choice of pastor, the fifth pastor that we are looking at this evening. And this man is Simeon Champkins. Simeon Champkins was born in 1867 in Bedfordshire, near Biggleswade, in a village called Langford. His father, James, was a believer and moved with Simeon to Trowbridge, having dying there in February 1917, a month short of his 88th birthday. And Simeon Champkins records that his second birth was in a Sunday school in Biggleswade under the influence of a godly teacher, William Batson. And little's known about Simeon's childhood, but at the age of 15, he left the family home and decided to make his own way in the world. Now, by that time, the family were living in Hucknall, near Nottingham, a mining area. And Simeon had already worked in the mines from the age of 8, but he was injured. But it seems for a while he went back down the mines. But he was one who followed the footsteps of others, and he walked 12 miles to the city of Nottingham to Chaucer Street Chapel. And it was here at Chaucer Street Chapel that he was baptised by Alfred Cawtrey in 1888. And he later felt a call to preach and was sent out to preach. And the church at Zion backed his application to be placed on the Gospel Standard list. So links with Trowbridge were formed when some of his children were sent to attend the school of Miss Gore, who was one of the members. And this resulted in Simeon Champkins being given an invitation to preach the first time in 1906. And in 1910, the church invited Simeon Champkins to the pastorate. And he commenced on the first Sunday in 1911. And among the speakers at his recognition service were John Booth from Bradford in Yorkshire, Edward Carr from Bath, and Joseph P. Wiles from Devizes. And during that first year of 1911, six were baptised. So this brings us now to the centenary year, 100 years ago, the church's centenary. Now up to that time, the church at Zion had not marked the anniversary of the church, which is formation. It was the building which they celebrated the anniversary of. The Jubilee was the 50th anniversary of the opening of the chapel, rather than the church. So by 1913, they decided the matter should be rectified and plans were made to mark the 100 years of the church at Zion. And as the church was formed in January, they took the step to have the celebrations as near as possible to the original date. And Wednesday, the 8th of January, was the date chosen. We're told the day began with a prayer meeting at 10:30, led by the pastor, when almost 100 friends from neighbouring districts met. A lunch of salad, cold meat and potatoes was then provided for visitors. And the centenary account records the service at 2:45. In the afternoon, the body of the chapel was well filled with people. The pastor opened the service with hymn number 1 and read 8th chapter of Deuteronomy. Hymn 289 was sung feelingly, when heart and voice went together. How sweet when the Lord touches the heart with his Spirit. The pastor then preached Hebrews 13, chapter 8, verse, to a quiet and attentive congregation, mentioning the names of many of the ministers who had been given to the church during the 100 years of its existence. Their memory was sweet. They had gone home. But this name, Jesus Christ, who is far above every name, is unchangeable, unalterable, the same today to comfort the sorrowing. We're then told 200 sat down to tea, and the chapel was well filled for the evening service at 6 p.m. when J.K. Popham of Brighton preached from Colossians 1 and verse 27. And the day's collections amounted to £20, 13 shillings and 7 pence. The centenary booklet, as I've already alluded to, was published, giving the brief history of the church. And it was reviewed in the Christian Pathway to quote, "What strict Baptist has not heard of John Warburton of Trowbridge? He was a quaint, peculiar man whose personality dominated the church during his life and even now can be discerned in his printed sermons. This account now before us is published in celebration of the centenary of the cause. This should be an interesting souvenir to all strict Baptists." The membership at the end of 1913 was 87, and the congregation numbered 150 in the morning and 250 in the evening. So we need to move on. And soon came the war in 1914. And we're not going to deal with that much today. But to say, due to the increase of the price of goods in 1917, Simeon Champkins felt it was needful to write to his deacons asking for an increase in salary for the duration of the war. And the church decided that a collection for the pastor should be taken twice a year as long as the war continued. After the trauma of the First World War, Simeon Champkins' ministry in Trowbridge was drawing to a close. And so we need to start summing up the years that we've been considering. For by now, there were two strict Baptist churches in existence in Trowbridge. And we need to touch on the formation of the church in the Halve in 1896, as this has a bearing in the next part of our story. As we've seen in the 1850s, in the later part of Warburton's day, there were serious problems in the church. Yet this did not lead, as had happened in many other cases, to the church splitting. But in 1894, events happened which caused a division in the church. Now, the problem started with a difference of opinion between the four deacons. The centenary account records it was over a personal matter as opposed to a matter of belief. But three deacons left, taking with them about 30 members. Now, Alfred Peat had, at the close of his pastorate in 1901, sought to bring a reconciliation between these two churches. But the Zion deacons were having nothing of it. Now, remember I mentioned Sarah Gore. Her brother was John Gore, one of the deacons at that time. The Zion deacons were having nothing of it, for they ruled the whole matter as out of order, as the members had been suspended and been set aside from membership. The deacons then in 1901 would not allow a resolution to be brought forward concerning this. But Simeon Champkins, it seemed, followed the same path. In January 1918, he wrote to the church in the Halve, asking if they would be willing to return to Zion. And if they would be so willing, he would be willing to resign the pastorate. Now, what events brought about this proposal is not known at all. But the facts are that the Zion deacons were the same deacons as the same men in 1901. And if Champkins had mentioned to the church this, then it's not recorded in the Zion church records. The only mention is in the Halve records. The obituary of Simeon Champkins records, during his time at Zion, he was truly happy there. The Lord blessed his word with many signs and seals following. In March 1922, Simeon Champkins received a call from the church at Loughborough. And he was asked to take the pastorate there. He accepted that call. And the Zion Church book records that the expressions of goodwill for our best wishes be extended to Mr. Champkins for his future prosperity and spiritual welfare in his new sphere of labour, and to the church and people to whom he will in due course minister to and live amongst. Now, his obituary records, ultimately difficulties arose in the church at Zion, and our friend resigned the pastorate. He commenced to itinerate among the churches until called to accept the pastorate at Loughborough. So I want to close by looking at Zion and the position with the Gospel Standard movement at that time. Was the church at Zion moving away from its position as a Gospel Standard church by the time of its centenary and in subsequent years? The reason I ask this are based on the following facts. Firstly, the church at Zion had never adopted the additional articles adopted by the Gospel Standard churches in 1878, although the church articles of faith were until 1966 based on the 1872 Gospel Standard beliefs. Secondly, after the formation of the church in the Havre in 1896, the Havre increasingly became the Gospel Standard church in the town. This is a picture of the Havre. J.K. Popham, the renowned editor of the Gospel Standard, only once ever preached at Zion, that being the evening of the centenary service in January 1913. Yet he preached at the Havre on quite a number of occasions. Thirdly, the position of Simeon Champkins regarding the Gospel Standard. As I have mentioned, Champkins was brought up as a Gospel Standard man. He came from Chaucer Street, Nottingham. He was baptised by Cawtrey, a one-time editor of the Gospel Standard. But this is what Simeon Champkins wrote a few years after leaving Trowbridge. "I am due on 15th of August at Colne. This is not one of our causes. They are called Ingolmanites, a set of really godly people. Men staunch for God's separating truths and a strict adherence to the principles of the gospel in their lives and conduct. They heard me preach in Lancashire and had a time of refreshing. If their own words were true, I cannot write more for time. But I don't mind what the Gospel Standard Committee will do, and I am not troubled. I am not serving a committee, but God. I should like a tour among the free willers, anywhere, everywhere, where God opens a door. And by God's help and grace, I would not take a gospel, but the gospel of our Lord and Saviour, Jesus Christ. If they take me off the Gospel Standard, my God will not turn his unworthy servant away. So bless his dear name. Poor, poor things, they need our prayers, and surely a little more of the Spirit of Christ to break them down. I pity them. They have got money and position. But where is the grace, pity, compassion, help, and mercy?" So wrote Simeon Champkins. Now, when the next pastor came in 1928, he refused to give his assent to the Gospel Standard Articles, and the church at Zion upheld him as a minister of free and sovereign grace. Simeon Champkins remained as pastor at Loughborough for 8 years, before retiring to Beeston in Nottingham, where he died in July 1948 at the age of 81. And his obituary was placed in the Christian Pathway. And as we've seen, this obituary recorded a situation that existed. Ultimately, difficulties arose in the church. This was at variance to the fact in the Zion records. Was it that Zion was starting to move away from the Gospel Standard position? Or was it Simeon Champkins himself who was losing faith in the Gospel Standard movement? There are but few sermons of Champkins in print, but it would be a useful exercise to peruse if in his preaching there was a change of emphasis. Maybe a question that we will not be able to answer. But here we must leave the church at Zion, moving to the next era of its history. And there another speaker may speak of the years to come, maybe in many years' time. So ends our talk, but just to remind you of the fact, a couple of pictures, that the work at Zion is continuing, and last year we had the privilege of baptising two young men, and we received another four into membership this month. And the chapel itself has been renovated over the past couple of years, so the building is now ready for centenary celebrations, which will bicentenary celebrations, which will continue during this year. Thank you.